Hidden global networks of dark money are fueling the nationalist wave. Today we find out how. We talk to the author of a path-breaking new book on the global threat to democracy.
A major last-minute infusion of secretive dark money.
Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini says he's never taken, quote, a ruble, a euro, a dollar, or a liter of vodka in Russian funds.
The most effective personality modeling is when you feed fear-based messaging to people that were modeled to be neurotic.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Nigel Farage.
You've said in an interview previously that you've received one big donation.
At 160.
Who's that from?
Yeah, no. Oh yes, I'm really going to tell you his name, aren't I?
Oh, why not?
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we're joined by Peter Gagan, a journalist at Open Democracy and author of Democracy for Sale, Dark Money and Dirty Politics, a forensic new book looking at the hidden finance behind the global far-right insurgency. We talk to him about the findings from years of investigative journalism and what we can do to try and protect and strengthen our fragile democracies. As usual, you can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you would like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible, the campaign group that acts as the home of the European left in Britain. By joining us, you participate in our movement-building efforts to confront injustice, oppose disaster capitalism, and promote grassroots internationalism. To join, support our work, and gain access to that extended podcast material, go to anothereurope.org/join. Hey, so Peter, welcome to the show, and congrats on the book, which is great, and we encourage all listeners to go out and buy it. I've been following your work on Open Democracy over the last few years and really enjoyed the book still. I think if I hadn't, I would have found it quite sensational to read because obviously it's reflected that longer term project and some of the details have come up. But if I was coming to it completely raw, I think I would have just been blown away and staggered by it. What was it that piqued your interest in all this and why you wrote the book in the first place?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have expected that I was going to spend so long. Basically, I spent almost the last 3 or 4 years writing and researching and looking at the role really of money and influence and disinformation in British politics. And it all started in a very kind of innocuous sort of way. I was up in Sunderland ahead about 48 hours before the Brexit referendum, and I was working as a journalist for the Irish Times, and I was doing that thing that journalists do before a big vote. I was going up and writing a colour piece, talking to voters, trying to get a sense of, you know, what are the big issues around Brexit in Sunderland. And as I was leaving the city, I was getting the metro train and I found the metro newspaper, the free sheet, and a big advert in the front of it and said, "Take back control," the big vote leave slogan. And it was a big fancy, you know, kind of wraparound advert, all 4 pages. And I looked at the back and it had the crest and the logo of the Democratic Unionist Party, who, if you think back in 2016, a lot of people in Britain weren't really very familiar with who the DUP are. And I'd worked as a journalist in Northern Ireland, and I was kind of aware of an anomaly in Northern Irish law, which meant that political donations were kept secret because of the troubles, because of the violence. So you didn't have to declare political donations. And so I kind of was thinking, well, that's kind of interesting. The DUP splashing the cash in a really big, expensive advert in England, you know, hundreds of miles away from the Glens of Antrim, where the party's heartland is. What's going on there? And then I kind of just forgot about it. I stuck it in my pocket and I sent a tweet and I just kind of got on writing my piece for the next day's paper. And a few months later, Adam Ramsay at Open Democracy got in touch and he was saying, I've heard you're interested in the DUP's Brexit campaign, because he'd been in Edinburgh in the run-up to the Brexit vote, and he'd noticed lots of vote leave placards, which all had the same little imprint that this advert had in Sunderland, paid for on behalf of the Democratic Unionist Party. So the two of us started looking into it, and we did a lot of digging, and we ended up writing a story about DUP's Brexit funding. And we actually turned out the DUP had spent almost £500,000, £435,000 in a Brexit campaign. Just to put that into context, that's about almost 10 times as much as the party had spent in the Stormont election a few weeks earlier before the Brexit referendum. You know, it's a huge amount of money in Northern Ireland. And it spent almost none of it in Northern Ireland. It spent all but 10 grand outside Northern Ireland. They'd spent it with the likes of Aggregate IQ, who some listeners might remember as the Canadian data analytics firm, which had connections to Cambridge Analytica, that Dominic Cummings had spent over £3 million with Vote Leave, and just by chance, the DUP had spent this money with them too. So all this sort of stuff, and it ended up being quite a big story in Northern Ireland, but also it kind of bled into the wider question marks about spending during the Brexit referendum. And kind of what happened in the back of that was I hadn't really done much work before looking at it. I'd been an investigative journalist, I'd written about lots of issues in Britain, but I'd never really talked that much about, you know, money in politics or and how political influence worked. So that's kind of started me off on this train that took in, you know, large investigations into Arron Banks, the Brexit donor, but then did a lot of work looking at think tanks, looking at the rise of disinformation, looking at political campaigning, you know, right up to the 2019 general election, and just in general trying to understand how unaccountable money, what's called dark money, digital disinformation and lobbying had fundamentally changed our politics. And I think it's, you know, we can all see it. We can all see that our political world is fundamentally different to the world, say, of 2016. And I think we're always struggling to figure out why that is. And I'm not saying that money is the only reason why, but I think we often underestimate the influence that actually even small amounts of money can have on our politics. And really what I was trying to do with this book, you know, I tell, for example, the whole story of the European Research Group, how this kind of small little group was basically just a talking shop before 2016. It existed for 15 years, kind of manifested itself then as this incredibly organized hard Brexit machine, and how tiny amounts of money, like really small amounts of money, just enough to pay for a couple of researchers, helped them to do it. And what I was trying to do with this book was really put it all into context to tell that whole story, because I think a lot of people are aware of bits of this story, even people who are, I think, are really engaged. They know, even they, I think, would struggle to put it all together. And so I was trying to kind of put it all into a context where people could say, oh, I see, okay, this is how this has happened. And also it allows you to kind of see how characters can pop up in lots of different places, which I think unless you're really in the weeds of it, like a journalist like I would be, you don't really understand. And you might say, oh, this guy's here. This lobbyist is appearing, you know, he's appearing on one platform with David Davis, who's the Brexit minister. Oh, now he's lobbying in the States. Oh, and he'd also worked for these guys. So trying to give readers and voters really a sense of how this new world of politics works.
And so if we could drill into some of the specific stories in the book, I mean, obviously we encourage listeners to go out and buy it, and we can't cover everything here. There's so much in there. This big DUP campaign, the most expensive campaign they ran in their history in the 2016 referendum. Who funded this campaign?
That's a very good question, actually. And I've written an entire book that started off from that one story. And I still don't know who actually gave them the money at the end of it. So the story of the DUP is a very interesting one, because in many ways, it's a great example of the use of kind of covert money in politics. It's a great example of how political actors will take advantage of loopholes whenever or wherever they can. Because normally at a general election, this had never been an issue really before. Because I'd looked at this issue, I knew it existed. But the problem is, or the good thing in some respects, is that normally a general election, which is the time you might want to route money through Northern Ireland. So, for example, the Conservatives or Labour could have their Northern Ireland office, which they have, well, the Conservatives do, and theoretically route money through it. The problem with that is the money has to be spent locally, and that's not much use to you in Northern Ireland, because it has to be spent in a constituent which is received. 650 constituencies, 18 Northern Ireland, that's not much use to you. But for the Brexit referendum, there was only one constituency, the whole of the United Kingdom. So that meant you could funnel money into Northern Ireland and spend it wherever you wanted. What we were able to discover was that the money came via a group called the Constitutional Research Council, which sounds very grand. When you hear it, it sounds like they might have a big office somewhere in London with lots of people sitting in there, like writing wordy reports about the Constitution and all the rest of it. Actually, it's not. It's what is in British electoral law termed an unincorporated association, another grand title for basically a couple of people, one or more people, giving themselves a name that has no legal standing. They don't have to file accounts. They don't have to have a website, give an address, say where their money comes from, anything like that. So this had been set up by a guy called Richard Cook, who was kind of a serial failed general election candidate, not far from where I am in Glasgow in East Renfrewshire. He'd stood against Jim Murphy multiple times and never won, former vice chairman of the Scottish Conservatives in their kind of their dog days in the kind of early 2000s. And he reappears then as the man behind the Constitutional Research Council, gives this money to the Democratic Unionist Party. The only other thing that they ever did was they gave money to the ERG for a Christmas party in late 2016 as well. And Richard Cook did reappear on the ERG's WhatsApp as well. But what's interesting about this, there's two things. One is We did a lot of work. I've done a lot of digging into Richard Cook over the years. There's quite a bit of it in the book. I think I describe his business past as like something from an airport novel. And he went into business with the former head of Saudi secret intelligence and a man who'd been involved in a gun running campaign in India, which the same guy does deny any involvement in. He's a kind of a series of unsuccessful businesses behind his belt. And at no stage does he ever say, Mr. Cook, that he ever gave all this money. He doesn't say that this money came from him. He just says it was perfectly legitimate and I don't have to tell you where it came from, which is true. But what's interesting about it, actually, even more interesting, is we would never even know Richard Cook's name or the Constitutional Research Council if it wasn't for when we published this story back in kind of late February 2017, there was a thing called a Cash for Ash, the renewable heating incentive scandal in Northern Ireland, which sounds quite dull. But basically what had happened was lots of farmers and a lot of kind of close, particularly close to DUP, were given money, unlimited amounts of money to burn wood pellets. And you actually got more money than the value of the wood pellets you burnt. So basically is a license to print money. And all across Northern Ireland, these boilers started appearing, burning wood pellets like Billy O and making a huge amount of money. And it turns out it was burning a huge hole in Stormont's budget. And it was a scandal and it precipitated the fall of the Assembly. So our story came out about 10 days, 2 weeks before a snap Stormont election in Northern Ireland. It was discussed live on air in a debate. Arlene Foster, the DUP leader, was very all over the place on it, hadn't really a clear answer for it. It kept on coming back. And I think the DUP felt like the only thing they could do was try and give out a name to try and make the story go away. They gave out the name of Richard Cook in a Constitutional Research Council. The story didn't go away, but actually, had they not done that, which they could really have avoided doing it almost any other time, because 3 months later, the DUP ended up as kingmakers in Westminster. But at this stage, the DUP was weak. They did badly in that election. They were forced to give up the name, and the name was kind of from where everything else flowed. So it just shows you actually, you know, it really was, even the stuff that we do know about it is just because of a very rare moment of political pressure and media pressure actually succeeding. Because in Northern Ireland, although there is now donor transparency, at the time, anyone who gave up any information about a political donation in Northern Ireland could face up to 6 months in prison. When you think about the fact that the highest fine for breaking electoral law is just £20,000 and there's no prospect of prison, that's a pretty steep penalty. So the chances of getting any information out of that were pretty limited.
And this is going to come up again in another story that we talk about in a moment. But just to be clear, Constitutional Research Council basically have no obligation to tell us where they got the money from.
No, they don't have any obligation at all. They were fined by the Electoral Commission for not registering as a referendum participant, but they're not under any obligation. And in general, I write about in my book, huge amounts of money goes mainly to the Conservative Party from true unincorporated associations, some of whom are very, very, very opaque. They are just a name and you have no idea where that money came from. In theory, they're supposed to tell the Electoral Commission all the donations that they give over, I think it's £7,500. If you look on the Electoral Commission website, there's about six entries and the last one was from 2014. So it's quite clear that's not what's happening. And after 2019 general election, myself, my colleagues, Open Democracy, looked at spending by the Conservatives, particularly in kind of red wall seats, and found huge amounts of money coming through unincorporated associations into candidates there. And again, you just don't know where the money comes from.
Wow. The biggest referendum donor is a name that will be familiar to our listeners, Aaron Banks, the well-known UKIP donor. This is one hell of a story that is also like an airport novel, and it could be the stuff of a McMafia style Hollywood film, to be honest. I don't know if you've had any offers yet to turn this research into such a thing, but could you give us the rough outline on his extremely secretive business empire and the exotic links he has to Vladimir Putin's Russia?
There is definitely an element of Blofeld or something like that in Aaron Banks. If he didn't exist, you'd almost want to invent him. The short answer really is Aaron Banks was an unsuccessful Conservative council candidate in the 80s, given a little bit of money to the Tory party, ran a couple of insurance businesses that were moderately successful, not massively successful. And out of nowhere, really, in like kind of 2013, 2014, he appears saying he's going to give £100,000 to UKIP. And William Hague is asked about this and he says, you know, I've never heard about him. He says he's a former donor who's really annoyed with David Cameron's kind of weak stance on Europe. I'm going to give this money to UKIP and that shows that UKIP are kind of back in the game. We need to get out of the European Union. And then Banks does a very Banks thing where he turns around and says, you know, oh, you've never heard of me, have you? I'm going to give £1 million. You know, it's, and he's kind of this sort of character. This is where he kind of exploded onto the British political scene, really, as this kind of big UKIP donor. But what's interesting about that, even that little anecdote, which is very classic Aaron Banks, normally if someone says that, they say, I'm going to give £1 million political party. What do you think? They're going to write a cheque for £1 million, signed by A. Banks, here you go. Actually, what happened was Aaron never gave £1 million. I think he gave about £600,000 or £700,000 in drips and drabs, mainly through some of his holding companies. Some of it was through himself, but not most of it, which was typical Aaron Banks. There's a really big bombastic statement, and underneath it is a kind of lot of convoluted stuff, a lot of confusion, a lot of kind of what's going on. We don't really know here. Anyway, fast forward about 2 years and Leave.eu, which is one of the kind of rival to Vote Leave, appears as a kind of really the most hard-nosed and most truculent and combative of and aggressive of the Leave campaigns. You know, really unabashedly anti-immigration, really hardline. As my reporting was able to show, actually, subsequently, they tried to hire Cambridge Analytica. They've been in conversations with Steve Bannon about soliciting donations from the United States for their campaign, which is illegal under British electoral law. And really the most aggressive campaign I think we'd seen in Britain before, running really aggressive Facebook ads and really kind of target Labour voters with very, very extreme messaging. And so this is the yin to Vote Leave Yang, if you want, and with Nigel Farage at the head of it. And Aaron Banks, through the course of the referendum, kind of from nowhere becomes this kind of guy. He ends up on couches talking about British politics and becomes a figure. Subsequently, what starts to emerge is more and more details reporting, A, about Aaron Banks' business empire. And as often happens in journalism, when one person cites a statistic or something, it can end up taking on life of its own. And I think it was a Sunday Times rich list said he was worth $250 million, which I think is a figure Aaron probably gave them himself. And then that got trotted out all the time, so everyone was like, this mega rich donor. But when you look at Aaron Banks's businesses, actually, it's a lot less going on or a lot less money going to them. They're very convoluted, really labyrinthine business structures, often which end up based offshore. So it becomes really hard to see where money is coming in from. But clearly not worth anywhere near $250 million. I'd say worth about a tenth of that. And that's a tenth of it, like in terms of assets. So he claimed to have spent anything up to £7 million or £8 million during the Brexit referendum, which is a huge amount of money for someone who's got assets of that. That's not even liquid cash. So I started myself and colleagues, but lots of other colleagues started reporting on this. And lots of the kind of details of Aaron Banks's story are really kind of, you know, he was bankrolling a political party in Lesotho that he claimed at one stage that he was advising a political party in Lesotho. But we were able to find out that actually he'd been transferring money into the party leader's bank account and all sorts of and crazy kind of stories about diamond mines and gold mines with nothing in them in southern Africa. So all this stuff started kind of swirling around Aaron Banks. And Aaron really enjoyed this, I think, too. He enjoyed this kind of notoriety. I think he got a great kick out of it as well. And then it kind of reaches apotheosis about 2 years ago when details of Aaron Banks' links to Russia came out. And so Aaron had married a quite prominent Russian woman, Yekaterina from Yekaterinburg, who kind of had an interesting backstory, shall we say, an interesting arrival into Britain when she met a sailor in Portsmouth in the late 90s when she was sunbathing near the naval base. And they got together and she got married to him and she got a visa and she stayed. And if any listeners remember Mike Hancock, the disgraced former Liberal Democrat MP, who had also kind of interesting links with Russia, she kind of was brought into that story. And fast forward a few years later, this woman meets Aaron Banks and they get married. And what then subsequently emerged, and Aaron had written in his book, his ghost-written autobiography, Bad Boys of Brexit, which I think I've read more than any book in my entire life, which is really depressing. I think I know bits of it possibly off by heart, which is really sad. And in it, he does write about going to meet the Russian ambassador. But then subsequently emerged through reporting from Carol Cadwallader and others that there have been a series of meetings. There have been lots of meetings between Banks and the Russians. He'd been offered things like chances to invest in gold mines. He'd been offered a series of inducements. And the whole kind of thing swirled around. And it always has been Banks and his sidekick, Andy Wigmore, have really always kind of have encouraged this too. When they appeared at the DCMS committee, Department for Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, inquiring into fake news, you know, they're asked about their links. And Andy Wigmore said, the Russian for no for any of these kind of meetings with Russia. And they kind of played up into all of this. But what's interesting at the back of all this, and like the book goes into some details about the machinations of these stories, and they are, I think there probably is a Hollywood movie in it. But what eventually happened was the Electoral Commission decided they were going to have an inquiry. They had reasons to kind of believe that the money hadn't come from banks as British companies. And under British electoral law, it has to come from a British or Irish company to be a registerable donation. So then the NCA, the National Crime Agency, looked into it.
He's thought to be the biggest single donor to any campaign in British history. But now the Electoral Commission has referred him and his funding to the National Crime Agency, the highest police body in the land.
Oh, what the NCA found at the end of it, which was quite interesting actually, they found that the money had come from one of Arron Banks's Isle of Man companies, and then that was okay. That was fine. So they decided it was a registerable donation, which sounds a bit dull, but what that basically means is an Isle of Man company is very, very opaque. It's very hard to know what's going on in an Isle of Man company. It's an offshore vehicle. Even the NCA would struggle to know what's going on inside an Isle of Man company. And basically what the NCA were doing was saying it's okay for foreign shell companies to give money into British politics, which is a really dangerous precedent because, as we all know, like the offshore world, which all flows to the City of London anyway, is so opaque. It's so incredibly opaque. And the idea that donors and others could funnel money through offshore companies into British politics really actually, in many ways, could create all sorts of, you know, unintended consequences down the line. So Arron Banks was able to turn around and say, look, I've been exonerated completely. I'm going to sue the Electoral Commission. And we end up with a much weaker electoral law at the end of it, which is quite remarkable. Fast forward then to the general election. Leave.eu is a massive behemoth. We're actually seeing it right this week. We're talking as this kind of Brexit potential no deal scenario seems to be growing, and the withdrawal agreement is about to be, looks like it might be about to be set on fire. And Leave.eu on Facebook have over a million supporters, which is a huge number. And it's a very good, I talk a little bit in the book about how they might have got all those supporters, because it's a very hard thing to get that many supporters on Facebook. And they've been pumping out lots of hard Brexit stuff, as they've done throughout the last 4 years, and have been very effective. You know, they ran targeted ads against what they saw as pro-EU MPs, people like Damien Collins, the head of the fake news inquiry. And I think were really influential. Again, this speaks to this idea of pushing the discourse. They were really influential, I think, in those kind of the 2017 to 19 hung parliament years, with pushing that kind of hard Brexit further and further. For those Tory MPs who were sitting on the fence and wavering, having someone like Arron Banks breathing down your neck, threatening to run candidates against you, running Facebook ads against you, targeting you on Facebook, all fed into that kind of maelstrom that we saw. So, you know, I think he has had a real impact on British politics in many respects. So maybe he is due a biopic of some description. I think they would struggle, whoever makes the film would definitely struggle to kind of disentangle his companies and his business affairs, as even, you know, as I did at times, but they might have a bit of crack with it.
And of course, there's a pattern here that's observable very clearly between the Constitutional Research Council and Arron Banks's Isle of Man company, because in both cases, they end up listed as the source of the donation. But we don't know where those actors got their money from, and it could be from anywhere in the world, right?
Exactly. That's the thing. Like, people often ask me, especially say, like, what are the Constitutional Research Council doing now? And it's like, it's not a thing. Like, there's something interesting about when you name something as a thing, it makes it feel like a thing. Like, we could be a thing now if we wanted to be. The Unconstitutional Research Council. Here now, we are literally, we can now, right now, we are now an unincorporated association. And if we wanted to, we can make a political donation. And I'm not paying for it just to be, I'll let you pay for it, Luke, if you want. I'm joking, but I'm also being serious, because there's a kind of thing that happens by almost treating what are legal fictions and loophole and abuses of law as if they are real things. We kind of think that there must be lots and lots of people behind this, but actually there doesn't need to be lots and lots of people behind it. In the same way that, you know, an Occam's razor take on Arron Banks is still probably like a not particularly successful businessman, wants to get his name out there and quite enjoys the notoriety, so plays up to everything. And there comes a point, as I make in the book, separating fact from fiction in the life of Arron Banks, I'm not sure anyone will ever get to the bottom of that. And that makes it, when people are going to be like that, it then becomes very easy to kind of abuse the system, because you don't really know at the end of it. We don't know where the Constitutional Research Council's money actually came from. You have a name, but it doesn't actually tell you anything.
And the story is not over in that sense. That was my feeling when I was reading the book. I mean, lifetimes are not infinite, but they're pretty long. I mean, you basically need one whistleblower, don't you, who falls out with him at some point in his life and tells you everything. And maybe that person is still mates with them at the moment, but at some point, you know, people tend to fall out, and that's what you need, right? And then we're going to know everything. Or maybe that's optimistic.
Well, I'm not sure how many of them will be listening to the podcast, but if they are, just give me a shout. You won't struggle to find me. On a serious note, I spoke to a lot of people who had worked for Aaron Banks' campaign. So one of the things I did was, like, I was also just interested in what, like, beyond the kind of lurid headlines as well, of, like, the nuts and bolts of it. So, you know, and of the political campaign and how his business empire works. So I ended up speaking to a lot of people who'd worked for Leave.eu and a lot of people who worked for his insurance business. And Aaron had appeared in Parliament and said that these two things were totally separate. And that's just not true. You know, it's very clear from a lot of emails, I got huge amounts of emails and speaking to lots of people, that really the two things were kind of, he was selling, trying to sell insurance to Leave.eu supporters and trying to sell Brexit to insurance buyers, which is very much the epitome of Aaron Banks, and getting people who are supposed to be working for his insurance business to do all of it too. And that was actually quite eye-opening as well, to get a sense from people who were in the rooms to try and get a sense of, you know, how these messaging was even being created. There's one point where he brings in a bunch of the insurance people to show them a Leave.eu video, and they're kind of watching it slightly aghast, and they're like, is this really true? You know, and he's like, what does it matter? It's propaganda. That's not what it's about. That kind of political campaigning, which I do think the Brexit referendum was slightly ground zero for, that sort of political campaign that we then saw in the 2019 general election in spades, you know, from the Tory party rebranding its Twitter account as a fact-checking account during a live debate, to a fake Labour manifestos appearing on Google searches. I don't think we've ever seen quite as much dirty tricks, especially online. I think that's where you can see where our politics started to bifurcate and our mainstream politics started to become fringe.
A quick shout out for a new series of podcasts I've made for the LSE about the causes of war and conflict in the 21st century. If you're interested in why conflict happens and how they can be stopped, then this could be a good podcast for you. We investigate the causes of conflict in the Horn of Africa, Central Africa, and the Middle East, and uncover the positive stories of democratic civil society resistance, promoting peace and social justice. You can find them by searching for Conflict Zone, that's Conflict Zone, from the LSE, wherever you get your podcasts from.
So another figure that comes up in the book is Robert Mercer, the US hedge funder who's backed Breitbart News and Donald Trump. He's less prominent than the Koch brothers, but arguably more significant. Can you tell us about him? What do we know about his relationship to the far right in the UK?
Yeah, Mercer's a very interesting character, and in some respects, like, what you're seeing with someone like Robert Mercer, the man who, like, kind of the biggest shareholder in Cambridge Analytica, a guy who made a lot of his money through a company called Renaissance Technologies. And basically what Mercer's background is in using tech for hedge funds. So he made a lot of money in the States, a big kind of tech maven, a tech evangelist, and a kind of a libertarian tech evangelist. So kind of not dissimilar to someone like Peter Thiel, who kind of sees the future in terms of the super rich and the ability to use technology to kind of transform the world to make money. And Mercer became, he's very much part of the right wing of American politics. Similar political belief to the Koch brothers in terms of very libertarian, low taxes, no environmental regulations. The stuff that makes Thatcherism look a bit like socialism. You know, they're kind of really pushing it to the nth degree. Mercer and his daughter, in particular Rebecca, became very involved, not just with Cambridge Analytica, but also with Breitbart. And I covered the 2016 American presidential election. I drove across the States. And I do think it's hard to underestimate the influence that Breitbart had in the 2016 American general election. And it's not just because it was a place that lots of people read, but because at this stage, and this is what Steve Bannon, who I interviewed for the book as well, realized, was that part of the way to get credibility back in 2016, not so much now, was to be seen to have things covered in the traditional media, the New York Times, the Washington Post. And the key for success for him was to get stuff that Breitbart was interested covered in these places, and which then Breitbart could spin further. So the Clinton cash story was the big thing, and basically that went into Breitbart, got spun back out. Mercer was really, really kind of involved with all of this sort of stuff. It was very much the kind of Robert Mercer playbook. And he was a big donor to Donald Trump and a big backer to Donald Trump. And Rebecca Mercer is very involved also with the Heritage Foundation, which is one of these big libertarian think tanks. So there's a big overlap in terms of, I think, what Robert Mercer's kind of worldview is, and I think the kind of worldview of some of the Brexiteers, like the likes of the European Research Group, and I chart some of that in the book, there is a pretty strong intellectual lineage between what would have been the fringe of the Conservative Party, people like Steve Baker, Jacob Rees-Mogg, who have long looked to America in a very, very kind of big way. And I actually talk about people like the Young Britons Foundation as well in the book, who were, until they were forced to fold in quite an ignominy before, I think it was around the time of the 2010 general election, 2015 general election. But basically what these were kind of small groups of conservatives that looked to America and looked to bring in American politics over to Britain. And I think they would have been seen not as being very successful. I think this is again where the Brexit referendum really did change the terms of engagement and change the rules of the game massively. You know, having previously been kind of sidelined within the Conservative Party, the kind of groups that would have looked to somebody like Robert Mercer and seen a kind of politics that they recognised and wanted to propose in Britain became increasingly successful. I think the European Research Group was really very much modelled on that sort of politics. It looked much more like something like the Freedom Caucus from American politics, of kind of Tea Party influence, right-wing Republicans, than it did the kind of traditional grouping in British politics. And it's a long-winded way of saying, like, in terms of actual engagement in British politics, I'm not sure if Mercer has been particularly engaged on the ground level. But I think the kind of ideology and the worldview that he has funded has been massively in it. You know, because Cambridge Analytica didn't come out of Robert Mercer, it kind of came out of British military intelligence. But Robert Mercer basically owned the company and pushed it in directions that he wanted to push it in. So, you know, and the kind of the model of targeting voters, the model of spreading disinformation as much as you can, of spreading misinformation, even if Cambridge Analytica were, it was in their interest to oversell what it was they were doing, I still think they were kind of leaning into something that was happening anyway, which is the kind of way the internet has allowed politicians and allowed political campaigns just completely change how they interact with voters in ways that we're still not really able to get a handle on.
When people talk about hedge funders and what their interest in politics might be, the fear is that unlike the kind of classic elite overproduction where rich people just feel like they deserve more of a role, people with hedge funds are actively seeking volatility because it just suits them. That's kind of a terrifying new development, right?
Yeah, I think it is. There's one school of thought that says, like, this is the hedge fund play. You know, the hedge funds are trying to get volatility in a moment to make money. I'm not convinced by that, I must confess. I'm not convinced having looked at the data on that. And I actually think what's happening is even more scary, which is basically, if you look at the funding pattern of the Conservative Party in Britain, it's overwhelmingly funded by hedge funds now in terms of hedge fund people. And hedge funds are a very particular type of finance capital. They often are people like Crispin Odie, the Vote Leave donor who used to be married to Rupert Murdoch's daughter, who made all that money shorting Sterling on the night of the referendum, having spent loads of money on Vote Leave. They see themselves remarkably as anti-elitist, as anti-establishment, despite being called names like Crispin and having married Rupert Murdoch's daughter. They do see themselves as, because in the city, they're looked upon a bit like spivs. They're not part of traditional finance capital. And there is a kind of hedge fund mentality. Of course, they love volatility. That's where they make money from. There's very little money in a world of zero interest rates, which is what we've had post-financial crash. There's very little money to be made in it. So there's a double-sided thing. On the one hand, they have a financial interest in volatility, but they've also got a kind of personal interest in both volatility and in being seen to being masters of chaos. And I think the second bit is often underplayed when you think about the motivations for people to get involved in politics. You know, some people give money to Conservative Leaders Group, for example, where £50,000 will get you a dinner with the Prime Minister, because they want to be seen like the kind of people who have dinner with the Prime Minister. So there's lots of different reasons why people kind of want to get involved in politics. And I think for the hedge funds, there's almost this marriage where the volatility is great for them on a financial level, but also it kind of speaks to their own self-image. Like, an Aaron Banks, I think, even though he's not a hedge fund guy, is in the same mold. This idea, like, we're not really part of these. They don't actually like the traditional Tory party. And you're right, the Tory party of, which was initially the Tory party, you know, the Tory party of the landed gentry, then became the Tory party, you know, of capital, and latterly the Tory party of the City of London. But now it's actually just this one little bit of the City of London. And a lot of, you know, all the big banks were against Brexit. A lot of the traditional Tory money is gone. It's really interesting looking at the funding. The Tories' funding stream is really, really narrow now. They're getting a lot of money. They've never got as much money in the Tory party, but they're getting it from a very small number of people, a huge number of which are involved in two things. One is hedge funds and the other is property development. And property development is a much easier, that's a much more traditional quid pro quo thing, because, and you can see to be blunt, you can see, given the proposals that are going through about changes to the property regime in Britain, it's quite easy to see why property developers would want to give money to the Tories at the moment.
So there's been a host of corruption scandals with the far right, both in this country and in Europe, which you also talk about in the book. Why do you think it's so common? Why do you think the kind of democratic response to it is so supine? And why does it not have much impact? You know, these stories break again and again and again, and it doesn't seem to affect the votes.
In terms of why they're common, I think one reason is actually a really banal reason, which is actually a lot of these parties would struggle to raise money in normal ways. You know, they would struggle to raise money from traditional donors because they're not going to get near power. They would actually struggle for members a lot of time, even if they get a lot of protest votes. That doesn't necessarily translate. So say the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany might poll 20% in an election from a lot of protest votes. It doesn't necessarily mean they've got mass membership. So they will struggle to get money in that way. So they will need to try and find sources of funds, especially in the continent where money in politics is much tighter. Private donations, that's one of the reasons the AfD in Germany have been caught up in corruption scandals, is for that very reason. There's a lot less private money in European politics than there is in British and American politics. So that's one of the reasons why you will see funding scandals around it. It slightly leans into the wider mistrust of democracy. And one of the reasons, I think, is a lot of voters think the politicians are quote-unquote in it for themselves. So they're not massively surprised when they see funding scandals, when they see political scandals. And so if they see a party that has a funding scandal, I don't think it really is enough to put them off. Like, as you can tell from my accent, I'm Irish, and I grew up in a climate where we had a hell of a lot of funding scandals and political scandals. And what I kind of noticed, and we still have MPs in the Irish Parliament who've been publicly named in corruption scandals over the last 20, 30 years, you still get elected. I will often ask people from these constituencies, why do people vote for these people? They know they are corrupt. And almost what happens is there's a kind of sense that we know they're corrupt, but we kind of hope that they'll be corrupt for us. It's hard to really quantify psychologically, but there's a sense in which maybe they'll do something good for us. I think that's why the Tory party were so damaged by the Desmond Robert Jenrick story about, you know, Desmond, the millionaire property developer, former owner of Daily Express, gives money to Tory party. Jenrick admits apparent bias in his property development in East London, saving about 40 or 50 million quid for Desmond, who's texting Jenrick saying this is great because it means those Marxists in Tower Hamlets won't get the money in the council. And I think that is the kind of thing which I do think is damaging. I think that's way more damaging than things like overspending, because that does speak to the idea that these privileged people get access and I don't. And that's the thing that I think Irish politicians who have been corrupt have been quite good at giving the impression that you too can buy some corruption if you want. I think that kind of feeds into it. I think because it feeds into the mistrust is already there. I also think partly their voters don't care. If you look at America, it almost feels like it's not the same thing, but every time Donald Trump does something that everyone thinks is going to be the moment, and it happened last week where he seemed to call war veterans losers. And you know, you can see all these column inches. This is going to be the moment, his base, you know, and partly it's because a lot of people switch off. And I think that's part of it too. Like, a lot of these conversations are conversations which, bluntly, people like us have.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. This podcast was produced as part of a collaboration with the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung. For more information on their work on building progressive dialogues between Germany and Britain, go to fes-london.org. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we ask Peter about whether part of the problem is new technology, the medium, not just the message, and how we can build a much stronger democracy. Another Europe is the home of the European left in Britain. To join and support our people-powered movement, go to anothereurope.org/join.
It always feels a bit like special pleading. Whenever there's an election and you say this group spent a huge amount of money. Do you remember in the EU elections, they analysed who spent the most money and it was best for Britain? So sometimes it's as surprising when the right doesn't spend money as when it does. And I was wondering whether you had any thoughts on that.
What I try and chart in the book is actually how you spend money makes a huge difference compared to the very fact of spending money in politics. And actually, spending money in traditional ways for political parties is often not very effective. You know, the biggest single donation in British political history was in the 2019 general election. It was from Lord Sainsbury, and he gave £8 million to the Liberal Democrats. And guess how that turned out? You know, the idea that just because someone spends a load of money in politics, especially giving it to a political party, often political parties aren't particularly adept at spending money. They're not the best people you would give money to if you want wanted to spend it. And there's a bunch of reasons for that, some of which are just to do with institutional structures or political parties and why they wouldn't necessarily be the people you go to. What's much more interesting, and I think I kind of, in my book, I'm much less interested in the act of voting. And I say quite early in the book that I don't think the Brexit referendum was stolen. I don't even think necessarily the DUP spending £450,000 before the Brexit referendum made some great change to the result itself. I often think you end up in a kind of circular logic there. What I'm much more interested in is how money can buy the ideas space of politics or buy the kind of discursive space of politics. So, for example, I write a lot about think tanks, which is a kind of what we saw really happening from the 70s on in America, and I kind of chart this rise. So what happened was mainly a lot of very rich people realized that instead of giving money to politicians who can be very unreliable, as I mentioned, they often don't spend the money very well. They mightn't do the things they say they're going to do. You know, they might flake out on you at the last minute. All of these things are bad reasons to give money to politicians. It's much better to try and own the idea space within which ideas are discussed. So what people like the Koch brothers did was they never really gave all that money to the Republican Party, but they spent money on fake grassroots think tanks. They gave money to small groups on Capitol Hill, small groups of Republicans, but also spent a lot of money on things like kind of faux research institutes that would produce policy papers that would say the kind of things that they wanted. So instead of trying to bully the Republican Party into being in favor of low taxes, you funded the Heritage Institute and the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute, and they all pushed out huge amounts of papers saying how low taxes are a great idea. And I think that's the kind of thing that we've seen much more of happening in Britain in recent years, and not just necessarily around policies, but even just around issue-based kind of thing. So when you're seeing huge amounts of money being spent, say, on Facebook advertising, both by the likes of Best for Britain on the anti-Brexit side, and even more harder to pin down strange, opaque pro-Brexit groups, what that does, I think, is feeds into a much more like kind of the discursive space of politics, which I think is actually is increasingly in an age of 24/7 campaigning. I think we're almost in a constant campaigning. And the way we look at politics as just election driven misunderstands the way politics works in 2020.
Isn't there a case that it's the technology that drives a lot of these changes? So you quote Will Davis, the sociologist in the book, who makes the point that successful politicians talking on television try to sound as normal as possible, but on the internet, they try and sound as extreme as possible. So is it the medium rather than the message?
I think we underestimate just how much technology has totally transformed our politics. I was just reading Will's new book, actually. In the first couple of pages, he talks very rightly about how even in 2016, in the run-up to the Brexit referendum, we were still in this kind of technocratic world. There was a technocratic orthodoxy, and we saw a little hint of it in 2015, which what became known as Operation Black Widow, when the Tory party and David Cameron, in retrospect, quite foolishly decided to eat the Liberal Democrats' vote, especially in the southeast of England. They ran very aggressive campaigns, mainly online. We didn't see much of it, and it turned out to be very successful. But even at that stage, I think we were still in this orthodoxy. The internet has completely changed. The internet loves outrage, as we all know. It loves fulmination, and it doesn't have much time for discourse and conversation. And the internet politician, I write at length about Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party as a kind of great example of this. You know, what more could you want? A political party with no members, with about a couple of members, majority owned by its leader, that takes donations through PayPal, unlimited amounts of donations, has one man, Christopher Harborne, who's given over £10 million, including over £2 million since the 2019 general election. You know, would you look at the Brexit Party post-2019 general election and go, that's a party on the up? I must give them some money. But basically, as able to gain huge amounts of traction by a media performance. And Donald Trump, I think that this is the Donald Trump effect in a big way, though. If you look at the 2016 general election, Donald Trump didn't spend that much money. Donald Trump doesn't even need that much money because he gets so much revenue generated through advertising, or through free advertising, through the things he says. He gets so much media just from what he says. And I think that is a crucial thing. And I think it was interesting reading the reports about Kim Darroch's new book. I haven't read it. The former British ambassador who lost his job after those interesting leaked cables a couple of years ago. And he's saying that Boris Johnson, when he was foreign secretary, went when he was in America, talked to Trump's people about how great he thought Trump was, how much he loved his use of language. He loved his flexibility with the facts. He loved this kind of really simple narrative. And you can kind of see it in the way Johnson talks. And this is the kind of the move from the television era politician to the internet era. And I think journalistically, I think this is really difficult. I don't even know how to do this myself, because as journalists, we still cleave not just a television personality era, but two, I think, some idea of depth and conversational depth and analysis and things like transparency and things like this, things that are require rigor and some sort of deep engagement. Well, what do you do with that in the internet age when everything is rolling news and when sound bites are so hugely effective and where combativeness and doing the kind of things Johnson seems to be doing with the Brexit at the moment is often a very, very successful political strategy. I would argue it's a bit of a mix. I think the message has also changed, but part of the reason and the way the message has changed is because the medium has changed. And I think this digital party, when I talk about the Brexit party, we could be seeing more of that, not less of it, because it's become increasingly easy. I write about the five-star movement as well initially, to kind of set up these. And what's interesting as well is they're policy black holes. I interviewed Claire Fox, now Baroness Fox, formerly of the Revolutionary Communist Party and Spiked and all the rest of it. She was an MEP at the time. And she was like, don't ask me about policies. And she started laughing. I don't know any about them. And the Brexit Party had no policies, really.
They had 10 weird policies, kind of, from the right and left.
I was going to say that. They had a couple of weird, fringy policies. They were quite libertarian-y. A bit like a mix of Alan Partridge and libertarianism. So, like, you know, the death penalty for treason and murder plus no inheritance tax. And in Richard Tice, they had the kind of exact frontman for that. Smiley, jovially guy who you knew that once you scratched the surface at all, and if anyone ever asked him a difficult question, got quite nasty and quite difficult. And in an era when people don't engage massively with politics, or at least see it purely from a social media perspective, or get most of their political coverage from social media. And it's going to be very interesting, because there has to be said, Keir Starmer does look a bit television. Where we go now, it does look still like we have a television politician up against an internet politician at the moment in Britain.
And that kind of brings us on to what's the positive take home and where can you go next? But in a way, I am quite interested in that as a question directly to Labour rather than us as citizens. How does a person who thinks in depth and thinks in a sophisticated way adapt themselves to what you're talking about?
I think this is the huge question. It's kind of the difficulty, like, especially as an outsider in Britain, you know, somebody who's not from Britain reporting on British politics for a long time, is that there's always this double bind. On one hand, to get reforms, you're often looking for a Labour government to do something about things like this. But on the flip side of it, a lot of the things we're seeing are actually outworkings. You know, a lot of it started with Blair, the whole media management. So you can see a transition as well, straight through from Tony Blair right into where we are now. But also, you know, in terms of the two ways of looking at it, one in terms of just like nuts and bolts, mundane law changes and all the rest of it, Labour has never showed a huge inclination to really get engaged with a lot of this stuff. Partly because I think every politician in Britain has their own little mini referendum once every 4 or 5 years, you know, the general elections, first past the post. And if you're the incumbent, you know how the dodgy system works. Almost every successful MP will have overspent in every general election. They will have broken the law. Because the ceilings are so ridiculously low, it's about £12,000 to £15,000 in each constituency that you can spend in the entire campaign. Nobody spends that. We all know they don't. So, like, there's a ceiling of, we don't want to deal with this. We don't really want to touch it because it's a stink and we feel like we can make it work for us. We know the bits that work for us. So in terms of, like, legal changes and all the rest of it, I think so far Labour have been really, really poor on this and haven't made it an issue. And I think I'd like to see them do a lot more on that side of it. But the flip side of it, the other thing I think is an even bigger existential question. Like, how do you have larger scale engaged policy or political conversations about what a future looks like in a world that is really soundbitey, but also within which, and I think the government have figured this out very well, the outrage of your political opponents is a very successful tool. Like, people enjoy liberals fulminating, you know, and vice versa. Like, there's a mutually assured destruction circle that goes on with that. And because the kind of things I'm writing about, say it's giving contracts to your mate, doesn't become a public inquiry, doesn't become some big issue. It just actually becomes something that people can almost get enjoyment out of watching other people get really angry at. And you end up with a public sphere that doesn't have a hell of a lot of public in it, or it has very bifurcated sectional publics in it, having very, very narrow conversations that revolve around as much about what you're against and what the enmity is rather than what you're for.
Well, that wasn't a happy way to finish.
Sorry. I'm trying to get better at the happy. I guess quite a lot of people have made the point that in terms of political engagement, we are very skewed. You know, the demographics of politics are very, very skewed at the moment. Not just with the Brexit referendum. And the Trump campaign is going to be really interesting. I do think the 2016 Trump campaign and the American election is really, really interesting, because basically what Trump is trying to do is appeal to a very sectional interest. He has not made any attempt to widen his base. He is just trying to appeal to the same people who voted for him last time, but get more of them out. He needs to get out more white people without college degrees. There's less of them than there was before in 2016, 4% less as a whole of the population. But if he can get more of them out, he thinks he can win. And I think that's actually a really interesting test case for where we are politically. If that proves to be a winning strategy, I think it's very worrying, because I think a lot of other people across the world will see that authoritarians as a way of mobilizing support and actually going, well, if I can get very, very significant numbers of cohorts out. I hate thinking that American election will change everything, but I do think whether that strategy works or not will have repercussions globally.
Yeah, it's completely historic election and it could go either way. Did you see those terrifying polls that showed the disparity between postal voters and on-the-day voters? So postal voters overwhelmingly going to Biden, but might not be counted on the day. And on-the-day voters overwhelmingly going to Trump, but will be counted on the day. So you have this horrible prospect in this, as you say, extremely polarized partisan environment of Trump declaring himself the winner on election night, and then Biden saying, hang on a minute, there's millions of postal votes that need to be counted, and I think I've won with the postal votes. So American democracy is going to be looking really in quite a scary place, I think, potentially on election night.
I think that speaks actually to the previous point I was trying to make too, about the two things, the kind of legal side of it, the kind of drier legal side of it, and the existential question, because that's also an issue of electoral law, and it's the abuse of electoral law, which has been happening across America, from gerrymandering to statesmen bringing in these laws about you have to have the postal vote has to arrive by ballot day, not be stamped by ballot day, which is what it was before. And I think that shows you actually the importance of electoral law. And in Britain, we really do not give a hoot about electoral law. And we have this commission, the Standards of Public Life Committee, has an inquiry going on to the role of the Electoral Commission. And you might have seen some of the reports that the Conservatives are, you know, threatening to abolish it. I don't think the Conservatives will abolish the Electoral Commission, but I think in the same way as they've been doing with the BBC and other public bodies, what they're doing is lowballing. So you won't get reform and everyone will feel happy that the thing wasn't abolished. And so you won't get any actual positive change. You just won't get any change at all.
Well, on that bleak note, thank you so much for coming on. And thank you for the book. It's been fascinating. And keep in touch, obviously.
Congratulations on the book. It's really good.
Thank you very much for having me.